As Lynn said, this is the third week of our four-week series. And tonight I will talk about the third noble truth and also introduce the fourth noble truth. But before I do that, I gave some exercises last week, and I wanted to see if anybody had tried those and see if there's a discussion people wanted to have about the second noble truth. And for the benefit of those of you who weren't here last week, the exercises I suggested were to pay attention to wanting, to see if you could just be present for wanting, and to try once or twice to see if you could ride out a desire, to see if you could watch the wanting come and go. And I suggested trying that in meditation practice as well. So I'm just curious if anybody has anything to say or any comments about that.
I noticed that it's certainly true that if one just doesn't do something, that eventually one's forgotten about it. And I don't, you know, I didn't really go much further than that. It's just a fact that it goes away.
So did you see the wanting actually disappear, or did you just kind of notice sometime later that it had disappeared?
I noticed sometime later. I mean, when it would come up, I would just think, no, I'm not going to do that. And then at some point I realized it just hadn't come up, and what I was noticing was that I was doing something else and not thinking about it.
Thank you. Did anybody try the meditation exercise I suggested, the Jack Kornfield exercise? No takers on that one? Lynn?
I guess I have kind of an extended wanting. I teach, as I mentioned last weekend. I gave my final this week, and it's this overwhelming wanting people to do well and to see people succeed, and yet you realize you don't have control. I mean, that letting go of the result came from realizing that I didn't have control over everyone as I would like.
And sometimes those wishes, I mean, as a wish, it's not so bad, you know. Of course, it's like metta almost, wishing for their well-being, their happiness. So there's a fine line sometimes between wanting and wishing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually thinking about that, I just had an experience this afternoon of wanting to have, I'm about to go on a trip, and I wanted to have everything that I planned to take with me. And I forgot some things. And it was amazing how hard it was for me to let go. I kept thinking, well, I could rush back to work, I had to get all this stuff. And I could see the suffering that would lead to, like, feeling more and more frantic. And at some point, when I really looked carefully at everything that I felt like I really had to have with me on this trip, when I looked at it, I realized, I don't have to have all those things. And by just letting go of them, it really produced a lot more sense of ease. Sense of frantic, like I felt like I had to be frantic. Kind of letting go of that. And somehow I related that to something you said last week about wanting the highs or the lows and not wanting to be just kind of in the middle. that somehow that drivenness to kind of have all the details right seems to always lead to alternating between highs and lows and never kind of just being. So that's been an interesting thing to watch.
Thank you. Yes.
The thing I watched was not wanting something, it was always wanting to say something and being aware of that and just waiting and finding I don't really want to say that much or I don't need to. There's a lot of things that just take care of themselves. You just kind of relax a little bit and not have that need to want to fix it verbally or help all the time. Things kind of help themselves if it's given a chance. Which is something I've never done. I usually am very talkative, so I don't wait, you know, and I just want to solve a problem right away. It's kind of interesting to just sit back and not have to do that. It's very relaxing. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's really lovely. I hope I didn't indicate or make it seem like the only things that we want are actually objects, but they are things in our mind too. The wanting to do or to have things be a certain way. It's not necessarily a physical object. That's really lovely. Thank you. So are these things that you actually need to do, or
they would be beneficial and fun, like exercise. I can say, you know, like goals, wanting to stick with a goal, exercise on a consistent basis, clean out the garage, you know, change things around, organize.
So it sounds like there's kind of an aversion to actually doing the.
Right, I want to do them.
Right.
I had a little conflict going on, especially this last week.
Did you notice a shift in looking at the wanting?
No, I'm still actually right in.
Yeah, they can it can take time.
It's just like perfect pictures. I want to be different, but I'm just right here, so I have to accept that.
Thank you. So I'll talk about the third noble truth tonight. So this is the truth of the cessation of suffering. And this is the good news. After a couple of weeks of looking at suffering and the cause of suffering, now we get to see that it's possible to end the suffering. And this is really the good news. The Buddha didn't leave us with suffering. He proposed a way that we can alleviate our suffering, end our suffering, actually. And the Buddhist framework of the Four Noble Truths followed a medical model. When a doctor looks at an ill person, he looks at four things. What's the illness? What causes the illness? And that helps to determine what the prognosis of the illness is, which is the third thing. Is there a cure? And the fourth thing is, what's the prescription? And the Four Noble Truths follows this directly. The Buddha looked at people in the world and saw that the illness of the world was suffering. Not being able to be, we live in a reactive way that doesn't allow us to be at peace in our lives. So that's the illness, suffering. The cause of the illness is the craving, the wanting. And he said unequivocally, there is an end to suffering. It can be realized. And he gave a prescription, a path to the end of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So what is the cessation of suffering? It's the word most often used for it in the Pali Canon is nirvana, or Nibbana in Pali. Nirvana is the Sanskrit. And the clearest, most concise definition of it is an absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. I'd like to read a few selections from the suttas that describe this. And these are excerpts from several different sources, but I like the way they flowed together, so I'm going to read it kind of as one passage. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion, this indeed is called Nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, man aims at his own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and he experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, man aims neither at his own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both. And he experiences no mental pain or grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and naught more remains for him to do. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is his mind, gained is deliverance. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. One of the, an American monk of the Thai Forest tradition, Tan Jeff, is a writer, and he has written actually many of the books that we have at the Center here for free distribution. And he created kind of a poem out of the many analogies for Nirvana, Nibbana, from the Pali Canon. And I'd like to read this to you too, just to get a flavor for... It's said that it's very hard to describe Nibbana, so these similes kind of can give a little bit of a flavor. The unfashioned, the end, the effluentless, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, permanence, the undecaying, the featureless, non-differentiation, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, solace, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, the secure, security, Nibbana, the unafflicted, the passionless, the pure, release, non-attachment, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge, the ultimate. The Buddha said that the third noble truth is meant to be realized. And I take this to mean that it's an experience. It's meant to be experienced. I think the other three noble truths, the first and second, understanding suffering, letting go of craving, cultivating the path, that's where the action happens. That's where we work. And the realization of the cessation of suffering is something that happens to us as a result of that work. So it's not actually something that we can do. It's something that we experience. So how do we do that? How do we realize it? The end of suffering can only be seen in one place, and that's the present moment. Well, actually, that's the only place we can experience anything. If we're not in the present moment, mindful, we won't experience the cessation of suffering. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, says that we actually experience moments of non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion many, many times during the day. He calls them moments of non-clinging. We experience them many times, but we just don't notice them. They're overlooked because they're so subtle. Our minds are habituated to experiencing much more obvious or coarse phenomena. But seeing the moments of non-clinging isn't just as simple as turning our attention to the present moment. When we do turn our attention to the present moment, what we tend to see is the momentum of our minds, our habitual tendencies. Since the tendency of most of us is to grasp onto pleasant experience and push away the unpleasant, when we turn our attention to the present moment, we often see clinging and wanting. Mindfulness kind of functions like putting a car into neutral when it's going at 65 miles an hour down the freeway. When you put the car into neutral, it doesn't stop immediately, but it allows it to stop of its own accord by not continuing to add to the momentum of the forward movement. So to naturally let the mind stop means being present and non-reactive to whatever's happening. If suffering or clinging is present, mindfulness can be present for that and not add to it, and eventually it will stop. We will be able to understand that directly and in the present moment. That's the first noble truth. If wanting is present, mindfulness can help us to see that and help us to let go of it by not acting on it. The second noble truth. At one point when I was on retreat, I was experiencing a lot of loneliness. For several days, I was experiencing this very heavy loneliness. The landscape of my experience was gray, heavy, depressed, a very oppressive feeling, this loneliness. And one day during lunch, I noticed a thought arise in my mind about a time when a friend of mine and I had been having a very lovely day together. And I saw the mind reaching out towards this thought with the intention to become lonely. And this really surprised me. I was actually shocked that the mind seemed to want to be lonely. But I had spent a number of days being lonely and knew how much suffering this was. And the mind just let go of that movement towards loneliness. It's kind of like if you're grabbing a pot off a stove and you've forgotten the pot holder, the hand will release from that pot almost before it even experiences, the mind experiences the heat. The hand knows, no, let go of it. That was the kind of feeling of this release of the wanting for loneliness. I experienced that the suffering that usually followed or habitually followed off of that type of wanting didn't happen. I could see the non-arising of suffering, essentially. So there are also times when we are mindful and it seems like there's not much suffering or wanting present. And the Buddha gave some instructions, some beautiful instructions for us, how we can practice at times like this. And there are two different instructions I wanted to share with you. The first is from a very famous sutta called the Bahiya Sutta. And this sutta tells the story of a man who heard about the Buddha from very far away and knew he wanted to hear these teachings. And so he traveled for a long time and finally met the Buddha just as the Buddha was getting ready to go off on alms rounds. And he asked the Buddha, please give me your teaching. And the Buddha said, this is not a good time. I'm getting ready to have breakfast. I need to get my food. And he said no. But Bahiya persisted and asked twice more in the canon, in the Pali canon. If you ask the Buddha for something three times, he almost always gave it to you. So after the third time of asking the Buddha for his teaching, he gave these teachings to Bahiya. You should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahiya, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. In our own language, what the Buddha is suggesting is what we call bare attention. Attending to the physical and mental sensations without following on with a proliferation of ideas and thoughts. If we walk outside and see a blue sky, bare attention stops with that experience of the blue sky. It doesn't follow it with a reflection on, what a beautiful day. I should get my friends together for a picnic. It would be lovely to have a picnic. We could go to a park. Oh, maybe we should go to that park that we went to last year when I had my birthday. Wasn't that fun? And the mind will just go on and on. But sometime back at the what a beautiful day, the mind lost contact with the blue sky. In the scene is only the scene. When we can rest in the bare experience of the moment, we are starting to train the mind to recognize and appreciate what non-clinging feels like. The second instruction I'd like to mention that the Buddha gives relates to feeling. That's whether something is experienced as pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, called neutral often. Last week I mentioned that these feeling tones very naturally lead us to liking the pleasant and disliking the unpleasant, and then rapidly lead on to wanting and grasping. It happens very, very quickly, those moments from pleasant to liking to wanting to having to clinging and suffering. It just boom, 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 boom. It's so fast the mind can barely see it. But with mindfulness, it is possible to see it, to see that sequence of steps. And it's possible to see and stop at the pleasant also, or the unpleasant. It's actually possible to notice the pleasant or unpleasant without it leading on to wanting or not wanting. So here's an excerpt from the sutta that describes this practice. I hope it's okay to read all the sutta stuff. I hadn't done that so far in this class, so I'm kind of overwhelming you with it tonight. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not become greedy for pleasant forms or averse to disagreeable forms. He abides with mindfulness of the body established and with an immeasurable mind. Having abandoned the path of agreeing and disagreeing, he experiences whatever feeling arises, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, just as it is. He is not delighted or pleased with those feelings, and he does not appropriate them. Interest in those feelings ceases. With the cessation of interest, clinging ceases. So following this instruction, we see if we can notice the pleasant or unpleasant aspects of experience and see if we can rest there. Eating chocolate ice cream. This is pleasant. Can we just experience the pleasant and fully be there for the pleasant without it going anywhere else? If we stub our toe, this is unpleasant. Can we just be there with that sense of it being unpleasant without adding our normal reactivity to it? If we can simply rest with the feeling tone, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality, it breaks the cycle of pleasant to wanting to clinging. It breaks it so that the wanting doesn't have to arise. I find that recalling this instruction can be helpful, even just a reflection of this idea that our reactions arise out of pleasant and unpleasant, to just see, well, what's unpleasant or what's pleasant in this experience? So I often actually notice sitting at a stoplight that I'm impatient. And if I can just stop and say, okay, this is unpleasant, this feeling of impatience, this is unpleasant. The body feels unpleasant. The body feels like it's being pulled forward and there's a tension in the stomach. And not only that, there's a thought in the mind that I want to be somewhere that I'm not. And that thought is unpleasant. But actually, it's not really the thought so much that's unpleasant as it is the belief in that thought that makes it unpleasant. So if I can just do this as a reflection, it helps to disentangle me from the suffering that goes along with that impatience. So through our mindfulness practice, we start to experience small moments of release of particular kinds of suffering. We see when we understand a particular habitual tendency that we actually can see that suffering disappear. We also start to see that we can see that mindfulness will allow us to be present for the wanting, and if we let go of the wanting, the suffering doesn't follow. So we can see the non-arising of suffering. As we experience these moments, we start to see the promise of the practice and believe that, yes, it is possible. It's possible to fully end suffering. This inspires us to continue. It pulls us on in the practice, the leading. There's a feeling of being led onwards. Gil gave an analogy about this one Sunday that I liked and has stuck with me. Suppose your linoleum kitchen floor is filthy from years of wear, and you decide you'd like to try to clean it. And you're just kind of overwhelmed with the thought of cleaning the whole thing. So you get down on your hands and knees and you just start to scrub this one little square inch of the linoleum floor. And you scrub and you scrub for hours. And finally, that little square inch is clean. And you think, wow, look at that. And through extrapolation, you can imagine in your mind what it would be like, having seen that little square, what it would be like for the whole kitchen floor to be clean. And you think, wow, maybe it's possible. And then you maybe meet someone who calls you and says, hey, you should come see my kitchen floor. I got it completely clean. And then you know it is possible. So we're inspired to continue the practice, to purify our minds, because we have these moments of release, of this hint of the recognition of the possibility that the end of suffering is possible. And then we meet people, too, that inspire us because they seem to embody the quality of that freedom. So I wanted to just say that my understanding is that the experiences that I've been talking about, the ending of suffering that I've described in my examples, for example, that the ending of particular patterns of suffering seen in the moment, that's not Nibbana. But these moments are really crucial because they do inspire us to continue. Gil gave another analogy that I like too, and that is, suppose you have a rusty can, just the bottom of it is rusty, the bottom of it's been sitting in water, and it's dried out, but it's really corroded and rusty. But just the bottom had the water, so up further in the can, it's really smooth, and the further up in the can you go, the smoother it gets. Well, our practice kind of starts in the bottom of that can, in the rust, where it's all corroded and unpleasant and difficult to move around. But as we practice, things get a little easier, and we're up in the higher part of the can, where it's a little smooth and easier to move around, and then we get higher and higher, and it's smoother and smoother. Gil says Nibbana is like being out of the can. It has no reference to the can. So there's no way to really describe it. But those moments that I'm talking about, the release that I've talked about, that's like being in the higher part of the can where it's smoother and you're seeing things more clearly. So I think of those moments as moments of recognizing this is the path. This is the right way. It feels like it's headed in the right direction. I'm going to keep going this way. So it feels like a recognition of this is the path. This path should be cultivated. And that's the fourth noble truth. So the fourth noble truth is the statement that there is a path to the cessation of suffering. And this is the prescription the Buddha left us. It's the Noble Eightfold Path. And as I've said several times, it's meant to be cultivated. We have to do the work for ourselves. Nobody can do it for us. We have to end the suffering and see the suffering, realize it for ourselves. There's one lovely verse in the Dhammapada that states this. Just this is the path. There is no other to purify vision. Following it, you put an end to suffering and stress. I have taught you this path for knowing the extraction of arrows. It is for you to strive ardently. Tathagatas simply point out the way. Tathagatas is the Pali term for awakened ones. It is for you to strive ardently. Tathagatas simply point out the way. So the Noble Eightfold Path, the components of the Noble Eightfold Path are usually listed in order as right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This ordered list sometimes leads people to think that it's a linear path, with each one needing to be cultivated and developed before the next one is started. But this is not the case, and a simple reflection on the first one, right understanding, helps us to see this. Right understanding is defined in several ways, but the main way that it's defined is as understanding the Four Noble Truths. And in the Pali Canon, it's stated that a full understanding of the Four Noble Truths means you're fully enlightened. So obviously we can't fully cultivate right understanding before going on to the other parts of the path, because the full culmination of right understanding is the end of the path. But some aspects of right understanding, for example, knowing that suffering, this is suffering, and wanting to understand it, those are necessary before we begin. If we don't see those things, we won't start on the path. So we could say that the path begins and ends with right understanding. Likewise, all of the other components of the path have more obvious and more subtle aspects to them. And as we cultivate the qualities of the Eightfold Path in our minds and our hearts, we begin to see deeper and deeper understanding of them. The name itself, the Eightfold Path, indicates that all of the aspects of the path are cultivated together in our practice and can't really be isolated from one another. So, for example, we see that to cultivate right speech, we need right understanding of what is wholesome speech and what's unwholesome speech. And we'd need right effort in order to put it into play. And we need right mindfulness to know what we're saying as we say it. In our tradition, the factor of mindfulness in the tradition where where Gill comes out of, and Gill is very fond of saying that really all we need is mindfulness. The factor of mindfulness is kind of central. And we can see that if we're mindful and if we cultivate mindfulness thoroughly, we see what suffering is and what is not suffering. And the mindfulness also shows us how we can eliminate that suffering, what the things are that will help us to eliminate that suffering. So thoroughly cultivating just that one factor, all of the others will kind of follow in the wake. So that's another way in which we can see that all of the factors kind of come together in our practice. But that said, there's also a kind of a standard model of a gradual development, a gradual training, where there can be seen somewhat of a partial ordering in this list of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha often stated that the ground of our practice should rest on ethical conduct. And that base of ethical conduct supports the cultivation and training of the mind and concentration. And this is not a moral statement. It's really a very practical one. If we have broken ethical conduct by say, lying to a friend, if we sit down to try to meditate or to concentrate after we've done that, what we'll find is that the mind keeps going back to that incident. It spins out. It thinks, oh, I lied to that person. That person knows this person. I better make sure that they know the same story. Oh, no, what if they tell this person? You know, it's really horrible, actually. You know, I've been in this situation on retreat. And it's very, very painful. And the mind just cannot enter concentrated states when that base of ethical conduct isn't there. So it's really just a very practical consideration. So the training of the mind in concentration supports allowing us to see things as they are, clearly, with wisdom. So this is the gradual training. It starts with ethics, follows with a training in concentration, and leads to wisdom. Ethics, concentration, wisdom. In Pali, these are sila, samadhi, panya. The Eightfold Path fits into this framework of the gradual training, with sila, or ethics, being comprised of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, and concentration or samadhi being comprised of right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, and wisdom or panya being comprised of right understanding and right intention. So I'll talk in more detail about each of these aspects of the Eightfold Path next week. But now I'd like to open it up for comments, discussion, question, whatever people would like to say. Yeah, I'll try. It wasn't actually that the wanting came first. It was that the thought came up. The mind just produces thoughts. It just does that.
And how does that make you feel that you think about that because you want to be alone?
I think of it more as the mind just kind of pumping out these thoughts, and it's karma, it's causes and conditions that have led to a particular thought arising. But so once that thought was there in my mind, the thought had come up. And then what I saw was that the mind had this inclination to kind of jump on that thought and think about, oh, wasn't that a wonderful day? And I really wish I could do that again. And, oh, I'm so lonely here. Nobody's friends with me. And I can't speak to anybody. And I can't look at anybody. And it's just... the mind, I just saw that was the intention of the mind to jump on that thought and carry me into loneliness. So it wasn't so much that the loneliness was inherent in the thought, but it was what the mind wanted to do with that thought. So the third is that the cessation of suffering is possible, that there is an end to suffering, and that it's meant to be realized. So the first, second, and fourth are really ways that it can be realized. So in the first noble truth, if there's suffering happening in our life, if that's what's going on, then the instruction the First Noble Truth gives us is understand that suffering. And if we fully understand that suffering, and I experienced this, it was kind of surprising on retreat one time that I realized that when I fully understood that suffering, it disappeared. it just went away. It ended. So that's the recognition of the possibility that the ending of suffering is possible. Now, the third noble truth refers to more broadly than just the ending of particular incidents of suffering, but to the possibility of completely uprooting any tendency towards desire at all, so that we never again have that movement of mind that says, I want, I need, I don't want, I don't need. And the suffering that the Buddha talks about is pretty much based in that movement, that when we can just rest with experience as it is, without reactivity, there isn't suffering. Does that answer it? Is that helpful? Okay, the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering, which is craving. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And then the other piece of it, too, is that the Buddha gave particular actions associated with each of the truths. So the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, is meant to be understood. The second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering, is meant to be released or let go of. The third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering, is meant to be realized. And the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, is meant to be cultivated. So it's a very practical teaching that if we follow the instructions in the first noble truth, the second noble truth, or the fourth noble truth, we will reach that third noble truth.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little confused, and I don't even know if I can quite explain this. I know you're talking about the loneliness and the thoughts that went with that, and that's how you came to realize what it all was, so you could let it go. But if you have a thought, like when you're talking about the blue sky and just let that alone, if you don't have more thoughts with it, maybe you can't see how to let go. You know what I mean? If you stop yourself and say, okay, it's blue sky, that's it. And not allow all these other thoughts come so that you can figure out how pleasant it really is. Sometimes it feels like you have to go full circle to get back to the beginning, you know?
To some extent you do. You kind of have to let your mind do its thing and just notice where it is. So, you know, in a lot of cases, I've spent a lot of time picking it up in the middle of the, oh, we should go to the park with that, where I had my birthday party. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time there realizing, oh, I'm having this thought. But it does, the mind slows down over time as we cultivate this practice. And eventually it does get to the point where you notice that it stops at a certain point. And it's more that noticing, oh, blue sky, blue sky, blue, and that you just experience that. And when you see that moment, you begin to have a taste of that non-clinging. So it's
so it's not an instant result.
Definitely not. Yeah, definitely not. Yeah, it's something to notice. When does the mind do this? When does it actually when is it just with the experience? And there is training, you know, the mindfulness itself helps us to be present for what is happening. And if what we're waking up in the middle of is a thought, bear attention to the thought. Can we just be with the thought as it is without further reacting to it? If we wake up and we're in the blue sky, can we stay there? So it's sort of waking up where you are. And it trains itself. It actually does. Is that helpful?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Am I right to say that actually in this particular example it's not so much the goal to try to stop yourself blue sky, but to let it happen without get caught up in it, or in other words, attached to the thought.
Yes.
Letting go part, because it's almost impossible to stop all these activities. It's more seeing that it happened.
Yeah, the key is really to be present for it. Often we find that if we're present for a thought, just actually present for the thought, that the thought stream tends to stop pretty quickly. You know, that momentum of being carried away that I described is not a mindful place. So if we can be present for the thoughts, then they will tend to slow down. So yeah, the idea is pretty much to just be mindful of whatever you can. Wake up wherever you can.
Something I don't know about. I mean, I think that you touched on strongly, but didn't. I remember it was an interesting thing for me to realize that the Buddha actually did teach that it is no more remarkable for the mind to produce thoughts than for the nose to be aware of sense or the eye to be aware of light and dark and shade. And that it's the natural function of the mind. So it's not that we even want to inhibit that. It's just realizing that just as we don't try to imagine that we're going to have a tongue that doesn't taste flavor or a body that doesn't feel sensation, we don't try to cultivate a mind that doesn't have thoughts bubble up.
Right, exactly. Thank you. That's beautiful. It's it's just that that tide of proliferation, actually it's got a name in Pali that I really like. It's called papancha, which is that proliferation of the mind when it just gets hooked on something and creates a whole universe. That's the piece that takes us away from the mindfulness. But to just be present for a thought, it's possible. And the point also about it just being the natural function of the mind. It's not something. Actually, thinking is a very beautiful thing. Yeah, Lynn.
Yeah, especially, well, just on that point, thinking about the present. I mean, having thoughts that are your own experience right now, and keeping it there.
That's true. That's actually part of the training. I mean, eventually, you do have to let go of those thoughts that keep you there. But that is, it's a very powerful training. Steve.
The mind produces thoughts, but the environment you set up for yourself could overstimulate it. The same thing even with touch or stuff like that. If you want to feel sensations of cold, you know, go out on a winter day with no coat. That's not a very wise thing to do. The same thing with the mind. And there's a lot of practice that the Buddha talks about doing, which are related to both path, like guarding your senses. And, that's a very strong one of guarding your senses so your mind doesn't liberate over time. Things will calm down. Or, you know, if you talk a lot and constantly engaging in talk, your mind's gonna, you know, when you go to sit, your mind's going like this. Well, if you're more quiet, not to get, people see this really on retreats, a lot when you don't talk. And after a week or so, you think your mind has quieted down. Then when you leave the retreat, you find out, boy, your mind's a lot quieter than when it went in.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. There's so many different layers of thought. You know, that, you know, on retreat, you start out with this incredible layers of thoughts, and then you get quiet and you think, oh, you know, I'm really, really quiet now. And then you realize that was the thought. So yeah, the mind, it produces like subtler and subtler levels of thinking. It's really quite amazing. Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
And then, you know, the first thing is the Eightfold Path is right thought.
Right understanding is
okay,
first.
The second
thought one is right thought. Right.
So we can cultivate right thought in the moment, and also with right thought we can keep training ourselves to be in the moment.
Yes. Yes, and another term for right thought also is right intention. And that's, you know, that's that intention to stay present. Yeah. It's a very, the right thought is a crucial aspect of the path. Thank you. Yeah.
Can someone be in both places at the same time?
What do you mean in both places?
Well, in the future and in present time, sort of have a scattered picture of a being.
Let's see if I can say something that I'm not quite sure I understand the question, but I think technically, in the sense of the Buddhist psychology, there would be only one thing at a time, but they would be like really fast, quickly intertwined, like one thought about the present, one thought about the future, one thought about the present, one thought about the future. So that, but actually, those moments of being in the future or thinking, those are thoughts that are happening in the present.
Okay. Because I oftentimes find myself having to pull myself back into the present time, and almost like mindfulness, meditation, and telling myself to come back from my expectations and trying to control my environment or future, and actually just be in present time.
That's a helpful training, but there's also another way to do it. Mm-hmm. And you can play with this. I mean, it might be difficult. But the other thing you can do is wake up in the middle of that expectation. You know, you noticed the expectation, actually, because there was a sense of come back. But you don't really need to come back because you're already there. You've woken up in the expectation. So what does that feel like? What does the expectation feel like? What does it feel like to be in the future? Like I was talking about the impatience that I felt. It was kind of, that's a kind of a being in the future. There's a sense of my body being pulled and the tightness in my stomach. What does it mean to wake up in the middle of a thought about the future? So you can come back to the present, but there's also that trying to wake up in the middle of, you actually have already woken up in the middle of whatever is happening. And that moment is a very powerful moment because that's the pure moment of mindfulness right there. It happened unadulterated. It happened. You didn't really have anything to do with it. It just happened. And that's
a good point. It could be that I'm trying to control my, you know, it's the controlling, the desiring that causes the suffering. And so if I want to release that, it's like a surrendering to just being in present time. So I'm thinking that I'm controlling the whole thing. But actually, it's already there.
That's right. It is already there. Because you've got the idea to come back, it's there.
It's a matter of me being there completely, in a way.
Right.
Because I'm still kind of playing this game.
We often judge at that moment when we wake up. Oh, I'm not in the present moment. But we actually were. We woke up. So we can also, it takes time to get to this point sometimes, you know, that judgment is so habitual and so strong in us to say, oh, I'm not being mindful. But we were mindful in that moment right before. So celebrate, yes. Impatience, yes. What time is it? Okay, well, I've got my exercises again. I don't know whether they're helpful at all, but I'll put them out there. So a couple of exercises I'd like you to try this week. So we've spent a couple weeks trying to pay attention to suffering and wanting. So this week I'd like you to see if you can notice when you're not suffering. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean moments when you're happy. But just, these moments are probably noticed that would be moments that would be unnoticed. So when I'm not impatient at a traffic light, for instance, there's not much happening. But if I check in and there's no impatience, it's like, wow, you know, it's okay. You know, not much is happening, but there's no, like, pain anywhere, you know. I'm not, like, spinning out on something. I'm not depressed, you know. So there's that recognition, okay, you know, there's not really suffering, not any gross kind of suffering going on here. So just see if you can notice moments when there's not really any major kind of suffering happening. you can check in, a good place to check here, just to check in, is places between events. So if you've finished your meal, but before you get up, what's happening then? So try to just stop for a moment at the end of, after you've washed the dishes, before you dry your hands. Try to find some places where there's an end of an activity before you started another one, and just check in at that moment between activities. What's happening? So that's one suggestion. Oh, along with that last one is that just a comment that peace is actually quite a subtle feeling. So just see if you can tap into times when there's just a sense of peace. If you can begin to appreciate that, I think of that appreciation as being cultivating the path. The second exercise has to do with appreciating wholesome and positive feelings. So gratitude, happiness, joy, kindness. And this exercise is simply to just notice and feel what they feel like. So appreciation doesn't mean getting caught in them either. Actually, one thing that I've noticed, a tendency in my own mind, is that I'll like talk myself out of positive emotions. It's really quite astounding. I'll be driving down the road and my mind is off in some plan of, oh, I've got to do this and this, and oh, this has got to be done, and it's just spinning. And I go, wow, you know, this is unpleasant, this spinning, what's happening? And I stop. And what's happening is that I'm happy. And I had missed it completely because I was off in the plans of what I was going to do while I was so happy. So when I began to realize that, you know, I don't let myself feel less happy very often. It's something that I just began to check in with. When I feel happy, I let myself appreciate it. And again, I look at this as this is the cultivation of the path. It's being higher up in that can that I described. These experiences of joy, of happiness, of generosity. It's being higher up in the can. And appreciating when that happens is cultivating the path. So those are my suggestions. And I'll see you next week.